who's known to a few of us in the room in particular for his previous work, which was published in a book called Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. And he's not going to talk about that today. If, however, you are interested in either the science of sort of forensic DNA, if you're interested in what goes wrong in the criminal process, if you're interested in the death penalty, I do strongly recommend you read that book at the very least, if not buy it. Because it is a wonderful book. It's an award-winning book as well. It's a well-thumbed book on my bookshelf. Today he's going to talk about the new area of research that he's moved on to, which is very well summed up in this wonderful title of his brand new book, Too Big to Jail, about how prosecutors compromise with corporations. And so that's the topic of his talk today. As usual, we'll be here. Brandon will talk for about an hour. We then have 30 minutes for Q&A, and then I've seen there's some glasses in the corner, and I've been assured that there will be some wine coming in at about 5 o'clock. So if you don't get a chance in the 30 minutes or so at the end of his talk to ask questions or make comments, do hang around for a glass of wine and follow up on those points that are raised in the talk. So over to you, Brandon. Welcome and thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a very, very special treat to be here. And I don't think if it wasn't for Carolyn and for Roger even telling me about the possibility of coming to Oxford, I don't know that I would be here. And it's really a treat for me, especially since I've only just arrived a couple of weeks ago, for me to start meeting some of you who teach criminal law, criminology, criminal justice related courses around Oxford, or who work with the Criminology Center. Anyway, I'm very, very excited to meet some of you, and hope that, although I'll be doing a lot of the talking for the next 45 minutes or an hour, that we'll all have the chance to talk much more over the next coming
weeks. Sorry, Brandon, I didn't actually say, did I, of course, the most obvious thing is he is going to be around for the full
yes.
term. He's a visiting fellow
so
of All Souls. I completely yeah. forgot to say that.
Yes.
Apologies.
So I'm not just here today. Since I will be around for several months and can talk to you more about other things, my goal today is to give you a kind of a walking tour of this corporate crime book that I finished just a few months ago. Although it's very hard to remember what one writes in a book once it's out, I'm now working on cases involving actual people, sentenced to death and things like that, so I'm back to the world that I had been in. What attracted me to the world of corporate prosecutions is in some ways summed up by the title. And it is that artificial persons can, in a legal way and maybe in other practical ways, be responsible for some of the most significant and serious crimes imaginable. I'd like to use a particular case and walk you through some of it to give you a sense of what happens in corporate prosecutions today in the United States. The approach towards corporate prosecutions in the United States is unlike that in any other country in the world, except to the extent that many countries, including the UK, have absolutely adopted, in some places, whole cloth. And the UK adopted whole cloth as well. This novel US approach towards taking on corporate criminality. So it may be that corporate criminality hasn't changed that much over the last few decades. The approach of prosecutors absolutely has, in ways that are somewhat surprising in some respects, quite important in many respects, and I have many criticisms of what has happened, although I also admire the hard work that prosecutors do in this area. Anyway, I thought I would pick a local example for this talk today, and hopefully this presentation won't make you dizzy. It does move around a little bit. This man, Mr. Donald Bagley, had been the head of compliance at some sort of UK bank called HSBC. I don't know. I guess I've seen signs around town. Little mom and pop bank.
I have thought about the structural transformation of the bank's compliance function. I recommended to the group that now is the appropriate time for me and for the bank for someone new to serve as the head of group compliance. I have agreed to work with the bank's senior management towards an orderly transition of this important role. Thank you for your time. I welcome this opportunity to answer any questions.
So I quit. Does anyone have questions? How disappointing. If I did that to you, that would be a horrible thing to do. But this was before the Permanent Subcommittee of Investigations at the U.S. Senate. Chaired at the time, he has since retired from the Senate, which will do terrible things for both the enforcement and the study of corporate crime. It was chaired at the time by Carl Levin, who took these investigations incredibly seriously. And some of the reports that committee produced told us far more about some serious corporate crimes than we ever learned through the work of prosecutors. Since the likes of HSBC, they like to settle cases, whatever the type of litigation, quietly. Well, because of this subcommittee investigation, the resolution of this case could not be quiet because that committee subpoenaed millions of pages of documents and they brought people before them to explain themselves. Now, he had a short explanation. I'm sorry, I quit. Being the head of compliance at HSBC was leading a group that was unusually small for a major international bank and apparently of remarkable incompetence. But the size was a piece of it, too. They had less than 200 people doing compliance around the world across all of HSBC's operations. 200 people may sound like a lot for some organizations, but since 2012, when he resigned, and since HSBC was prosecuted, they've hired 5,000 to 10,000 people to do compliance at their bank, and apparently things still need a lot of help. So they had less than 200. That gives at least a very rough sense of just how shoddy their compliance was. So maybe they had 199 when he quit, but that didn't exactly address the problem. He did add, on a more positive note, that the bank has already learned from these past mistakes and is on a path to becoming a better, stronger banking institution. So he didn't just say, I quit, any questions. Now, what came out in this investigation? And frankly, in most of these cases, we don't know this in this level of detail what a company did. Many of these documents were made public in a lengthy report that you can read online that is on the website of the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee of Investigations, including amazing emails, which I could do a whole slideshow of just the emails in which compliance employees, some of them not like him, his predecessor actually complained quite a bit about how she just couldn't do her job in any meaningful way and was told to be quiet, stop raising questions, and then finally you're fired. So HSBC, as you know, an enormous financial institution spread over a remarkable number of countries and functioned at the time as sort of a loose collection of different banks without strong central oversight. They committed basically every crime a bank could commit if it really wanted to. The U.S. passed a collection of criminal laws, regulations, civil laws, all sort of under the heading of the Bank Secrecy Act in the 1970s, which requires that transactions be documented, that cash transactions of more than $10,000 be documented in particular, and one isn't allowed to just show up with more than $10,000 in cash at a bank. The idea is to combat money laundering. Separate sanctions laws interact with the Bank Secrecy Act, such that transactions that go to countries that face sanctions in the U.S., money isn't supposed to make its way to those countries, and transactions that are at risk for being directed toward sanctioned countries are supposed to be red flagged and targeted and shut down in particular ways. The U.S. Patriot Act, passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks, added still additional criminal and civil provisions to this whole array of banking statutes. And transactions that raise a risk of money flowing to terrorist organizations are also supposed to be red flagged, and banks are supposed to put a stop to them. So there are a lot of transactions that banks are supposed to be watching. They aren't supposed to be passive conduits for whatever their customers want to do in terms of wiring money across the world. HSBC apparently was indifferent in large regard to where the money was going and when. they bought a Mexican subsidiary that apparently had no compliance department to speak of and had been the subject of, I think it was Operation Casa Blanca or Casa Bianca in the late 90s, a huge money laundering sting operation. And so it was well known that this bank was extremely troubled and was being used by the Mexican drug cartels. They apparently designed cash packages to fit the specifications of the teller windows of HSBC Mexico's banks because it was the perfect way to do something that they really needed to do, which is move cash back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico. If you are a drug cartel, that's a big problem. You're dealing in a cash business. You need to get that money into banks and move it around. HSBC was the conduit. At least $880 million in drug proceeds were laundered through HSBC. It may have, there were, you know, over $15 billion that went back and forth, and to this day we don't know to what degree that $15 billion was made up of drug cartel money. And that was just Mexico. That was just, you know, that could be the subject itself of thousands of money laundering prosecutions. But there were also transactions, hundreds of millions in transactions, to basically every sanctioned regime in the world. Burma, Cuba, maybe Cuba not so much anymore, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Sudan, organizations suspected of ties to terrorism, transactions involving tens of millions of dollars were flowing to banks suspected of permitting transactions to terrorists. So this wasn't just one criminal investigation. This was potentially hundreds of criminal investigations. And if an individual in the U.S. is convicted federally of money laundering, well, all one has to have is a high degree of suspicion that money, say over $10,000 in cash, is related to, say, a drug cartel or to a terrorist organization. You don't have to. The person doesn't have to give you the cash and say, "I'm trying to money launder this for the cartels." If it's a real estate agent and the customer shows up in a gold Corvette or a gold Bentley, and says, "I'd just like to pay cash," and wears, outrageous sunglasses and maybe a gold suit, and the real estate broker has no actual knowledge that this person is involved in anything criminal, but figures, "I'd like to make the sale. This is a nice commission. I'll take the cash." Money laundering. And that real estate agent, who may not be intentionally assisting a drug cartel, can face just enormous sentences, decades-long sentences. Well, nothing like that happens when a bank is prosecuted. Financial institutions are never convicted of money laundering. And the reason why is that a money laundering conviction triggers automatic charter revocation proceedings at the federal level. The Attorney General is actually, it's a rare collateral consequence of a conviction that is required for a corporation in the United States. The Attorney General is required to make the recommendation to the Comptroller of the Currency and the Treasury that the bank's charter be revoked. That would be the end of the bank's operations in the United States. So HSBC US would disappear as an entity, would lose its charter if it were to be convicted of money laundering. So instead it's convicted under the Bank Secrecy Act. Well, it's not convicted, but it's charged under the Bank Secrecy Act, which doesn't. Charter revocation would be purely optional. Same for sanctions, violations, and some of these other provisions. And so prosecutors with banks tend to select charges that don't result in a corporate death penalty, presumably because they don't want to destroy the entire financial institution. Individuals, no such luck. Now, there are separate questions. Financial institutions are closely regulated. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency apparently was doing very loose compliance audits of the bank. They weren't actually checking transactions to see where they had gone. Banks may generate hundreds of thousands of red flagged transactions every year, and they're supposed to send reports of those transactions to the OCC. It's not clear that the OCC really has the resources to read any of that stuff. And of course, there's the question of, well, how about the transactions that they don't flag? Who reads those? The Carl Evans Committee described in detail how the regulators just, basically, if they missed this, then what were they doing? What are they for? So separate question, was the criminal prosecution that came out of this case the result of really scandalous failure of the regulators to put a stop to this before it reached this kind of epidemic proportions? What HSBC ultimately does, though, is they enter a settlement with prosecutors in the Eastern District of New York. Actually, the U.S. attorney there at the time was Loretta Lynch, who is the new attorney general as of just a few days ago in the U.S. She was asked, I think, a very brief question in her confirmation hearing about the HSBC case, and she said, "Oh yes, we're very proud of our work in the case." Deferred prosecution agreement requires some explanation, and it's a big part of what I talk about in my Too Big to Jail book. I'll say a little bit more about it later in the talk, but the procedure is something like this, and I assume that courts in the UK have some procedure like this, where if it's a juvenile, a low-level offender, a first-time offender, what the prosecutor can do is say, "Look, we don't want to charge you now. You're a first-time offender. This is a low-level thing. We'll file a case. If in a year, 2 years, you stay clean, you pass your drug test, you don't get into any more trouble, we'll dismiss the case. No charges will be filed. Now, if we catch you again, then you don't get off with a warning. But we'll basically give you the equivalent of a warning this time." And so the case stays on the docket for some period of time, a year, 2 years, 3 years, usually with individuals, 6 months or a year. And if the person shows good behavior, good conduct, then the case is dismissed. There's no criminal record. The origins in the U.S. are in a Brooklyn plan where the federal prosecutor acted, the same office that brought the HSBC case, experimented with this, they call it a diversion approach. Diverted from trial, basically. Diverted from the regular plea bargaining process. A basically out-of-court deal for a low-level offender, first-time drug user or a juvenile. Well, the idea of giving corporations, and some of the biggest in terms of money value and maybe social harm, biggest cases imaginable, that was a creative move to use that tool that was designed to let off low-level offenders who maybe shouldn't be considered criminals quite yet. To extend that to the largest corporations, that was a big change. That really began in 2003 for reasons that I'll talk about in a few minutes. Now, what happens in this deferred prosecution agreement? Well, with an individual, it's just don't do it again. Show good conduct, pass your drug tests for the next year. For a bank, good conduct means something somewhat different. The agreements themselves are often quite detailed, and this was a particularly detailed one. HSBC admitted guilt. It said, "We have absolutely committed Bank Secrecy Act violations, sanctions violations, Patriot Act violations, a lot of violations, we admit it, and we accept responsibility." Acceptance of responsibility is something that one must sort of go through the motions of in a plea agreement. The idea is, I am guilty and I feel responsible. It doesn't quite have the same atmospherics where it's the company's lawyers accepting responsibility in a courtroom. But the same language is there as if it were a guilty plea. But here there is no guilty plea, there is no conviction, and there will be no criminal conviction, assuming that the company follows the terms. And here is actually a 5-year agreement, so if the company fulfills the terms at the end of the 5 years, the case will be dismissed from the judge's docket, and there will be no criminal record for HSBC. They agreed to pay an enormous forfeiture, over $1 billion. But hey, $1 billion fines, that's totally normal in corporate prosecutions these days. It was not a decade ago. Somehow $1 billion fines have become the new normal. Every year there are a few $1 billion cases. Back, if you saw the movie, I'm blanking on the name of the movie, about the Insider? No, this is the antitrust, the lysine cartel conspiracy. It's the Insider, okay. And so it's a late 90s movie, and that was the era in which antitrust prosecutions exploded in the U.S. That case resulted in like a $30, $40 million fine, and that was considered a really big deal, a huge corporate criminal fine. All of a sudden, the landscape of cartel enforcement radically shifted because a company paid tens of millions of dollars. Right, that looks quaint in terms of the numbers involved in today's corporate criminal prosecutions. And actually, not half, but almost $900 million would be paid to the Treasury. So the penalties were shared as between the regulators, who really should have prevented this, and the prosecutors. There were no other payments because there aren't easily identifiable victims when it's money laundering. If violations of sanctions. In many of these cases, payments to victims' restitution, as it would be called, plays a big role. And it, where there are victims, actually a forfeiture, can that money can make its way to victims. Instead, this money basically went to the U.S. Treasury. There was a corporate monitor appointed who was supposed to watch over HSBC and report on what changes were being made. This is a company that, after all, had, you know, a couple hundred people doing compliance across all the 90-something countries that it had major banks in. So the company was required to adopt a new compliance program, new anti-money laundering systems. The company also was cited in the agreement. It didn't change its leadership because prosecutors told it to. But it wasn't just the head of compliance that resigned on the Senate floor, although that was more dramatic. But there's a new CEO, new chairman, new chief legal officer. The top leadership of the company really did turn over as a result of this investigation and then the prosecutions that resulted. Most companies that get prosecuted for crimes do not change their top leadership like this. And that's unusual when that happens.
Sorry, that was a term of the different...
No, it was not a term.
That just happened.
The agreement sort of described favorably how this is a company that's turning over a new leaf, lots of its leadership had changed. The agreement didn't actually require... That would be a big deal if prosecutors said, you know, we'll dismiss the charges here, but you have to get rid of your CEO. Yeah. That would be controversial. There has been a case where a corporate monitor reporting to the prosecutor told the company to fire their CEO, and they did. And that was controversial. The agreements also provided that the company must cooperate, and with very strong language. So they said that basically the company, and this is standard language, we accept responsibility and we agree to fully cooperate in any investigations of any individual employees or officers. We agree to provide prosecutors with access to employees to interview any documents, emails, anything they want going forward. Any related investigation, we agree to fully cooperate. We don't agree to provide privileged documents or privileged material, but any relevant material that's on privilege, we cooperate. And that's a significant term, too, and it's standard in these agreements.
Just 2 points. What happened to the company's share price after all this? And the second point is, if you've got 90 branches all around the world, not all of them are subject to jurisdiction of the U.S. authority, presumably. And not all of them are subject, I guess, to U.S. sanctions against various countries that American politicians don't like for some reason.
Right.
Can they actually enforce these penalties on Hong Kong or whatever HSBC happens to have?
Yes, the HSBC is not only has a U.S. branch, but it's listed on the U.S. exchanges. And so there is jurisdiction over the parent company in the U.S., and that's enough. You know, they can certainly hold the agents accountable if the parent. That has been the position of U.S. prosecutors. So far, no court has had a problem with it. And the idea is that if it's a wholly owned subsidiary, you have jurisdiction over the parent. You could certainly ask an entity to control its agents if they're committing crimes, and so that hasn't come up in cases like this. I'll talk about the share price a little bit more later, but in general, when these settlements are announced, the share price goes up because the company says, you know, that we've now put this behind us. Now, by that time, however, a lot of information has been out there in the market about the fact that the company was under investigation, the fact that prosecutors are considering a settlement. Company will have announced, we've set aside $2 billion to pay any potential resolution of the cases against us. And so there isn't this shocking moment when, oh my God, you know, HSBC has entered a deferred prosecution agreement and will be paying a $1.9 billion fine. Everyone knows about it. And these fines are also much smaller than they could have been. And so this, you know, $1.9 billion payment, under the, really it's an alternative sentencing statute, it's not strictly under the U.S. sentencing guidelines, a company can be fined up to twice the gains from any federal crime. And if you look at the, you know, there are many, many tens of billions of dollars of transactions, you could there was no attempt to do some calculation as to what kinds of gains did this bank make from all the business that it received. You'd have to do some very complicated tracing. There was no effort to ground this fine in the profits that HSBC made from the relevant conduct. And the fine could have been up to twice that amount. No company ever gets fined up to twice the gains or the losses to victims if there are losses to identifiable victims. The fines are typically a fraction of what they could be under sentencing guidelines. And so here's the whole agreement. Maybe not the most helpful way to read an agreement, but it would be hard to fit on one screen otherwise. But it talks about the parties and the bank and employees and what they did. These agreements also tend to have a statement of facts. And so not only does the company accept responsibility for what it did, but in a less abstract way, there's typically a statement describing who did what, usually employee number one, supervisor number two. They will quote the emails. They'll give some picture, at least, of what this company was doing, why it was bad, what was the money laundering like, what were the gross failures of compliance. Prosecutors want the public to know something, at least, about why this was a serious case. Although it's often, they don't name particular supervisors. These are somewhat dry documents, but there is a story that is told about what the crime was. Not like a story that would be told at a criminal trial, but no cases go to trial anymore in U.S. federal courts on the criminal side. It's rare for any criminal case to go to trial. About 5% of federal cases go to trial in the U.S. More go to trial in the most serious criminal cases. Very few corporations take their case to trial. There have been less than 24 corporations that have had a criminal trial in the last 15 years. HSBC was not about to have a trial. Just to give a sense of how big these cases are, you notice a lot of 2012, 2014, 2009. Many of the record penalties paid by banks have been in just the last few years. I thought I corrected this. This should be 1.9. For a range of different crimes. A lot of them are sanctions cases, some involving tax, Swiss banking cases. This BNP case has an asterisk. It actually has the judge delayed sentencing for some reason to allow for further submissions. The New York State Court part of it was just sentenced on May 1st, tomorrow. BNP will likely be sentenced tomorrow. And when it is, assuming the sentencing is completed tomorrow and there isn't a further delay, the largest ever criminal fine of any kind in the U.S. will occur formally tomorrow in a courtroom in the Southern District of New York. And so there's lots of French interest in corporate prosecutions in the United States these days because the big state bank, BNP Paribas, is about to pay just an enormous fine.
Brandon, read it out because I'm guessing people.
Yes, it's about $9 billion. So, and BNP and people in France are saying, come on, HSBC did things all across the world, not just money laundering and sanctions violations, but terrorism. They did everything. Why do they only get $2 billion? We're paying $9 billion. There are all kinds of questions about how prosecutors exercise their discretion in this area. These are all negotiated agreements with prosecutors. BNP is different, though, because that bank pleaded guilty, and so there is a judge. And tomorrow the judge could say, I'm not going to approve this plea agreement. But the HSBC is largely out of court. The company will not be convicted. It will not plead guilty. They entered this deferred prosecution agreement. Here's something which shows in a little bit better sort of what the trend is in terms of money. Although I begin my book by describing how, there's been this explosion in corporate criminal fines, I spend a lot of the book talking about why we shouldn't be overly impressed with just the numbers in these cases. One reason we shouldn't be overly impressed with just the numbers in these cases is that there actually have not been more cases brought against corporations since, say, 2001. In fact, slightly fewer cases have been brought in recent years against corporations. Slightly fewer cases have been brought against public corporations. And in any given year, the vast bulk of the fines, which make this look really impressive, are brought in a handful of cases. And so 2003 looks like a remarkable year, the biggest year in the whole group. But most of that big red thing there, that's the BP settlement. That's one case. It's the BP settlement for the Gulf spill. Now, the biggest environmental disaster in U.S. history. One wouldn't want to trivialize the costs of that. and actually the payments to victims, you know, that was a $20 billion fund that they set up because Obama told them to. That was much bigger than this, and what they eventually pay in the civil case, much more than the, you know, $4 billion they paid in the criminal case. One case, you know, 2009, that big pharmaceutical case is one case. That was the first $1 billion settlement of any criminal case in the United States with Pfizer. Since then, there have been GlaxoSmithKline, lots of big pharma cases. And so, in any given year, it's, you know, half a dozen blockbuster cases, sometimes just two or three blockbuster cases that are responsible for the vast bulk of these money awards. Yes?
It looked to me, and I wasn't quite clear if I read it right, but the list of banks, almost all of them seem to be foreign banks.
Yes, I'll talk about that in a second. So, really in a second. Foreign companies, not just banks, pay far larger fines on average. In fact, many times larger fines on average. And there are a number of different potential explanations for this. It could be that companies based outside the U.S. don't care as much about U.S. law, which would be understandable. Companies in many countries may be understandably unfamiliar with the very notion of corporate criminal liability. You know, when Siemens was prosecuted in the United States for what was and still is the largest bribery prosecution of all time, in Germany they're quite metaphysically opposed to the very notion of corporate criminal liability. And the concept made no sense. You have companies like, well, BNP Paribas, which may be sentenced tomorrow, which absolutely did not cooperate with U.S. prosecutors for understandable reasons, including, it sounds as if the French government, it's a part or maybe in a whole, a state bank, was telling them not to cooperate. You know, they had tacit authorization to send a lot of money to Sudan. And, you know, maybe the U.S. government doesn't like it, but we're a French bank and the French government seems to think it's okay. So they received a $9 billion fine in part because they were completely uncooperative. Whereas HSBC, a UK bank, there are similar laws, similar enforcement style in the UK, at least there is now. They understood that the right thing to do is to say, we're sorry, we will fix it, we will negotiate this with you, we want this case to go away. Some foreign banks may not get that message, or foreign companies, and they may try to, well, they may just not cooperate, or they may try to litigate it in ways that aren't helpful. Some of these companies don't cooperate at first, and then they realize, oh, we should be hiring a New York law firm that will just sort of make this go away for us. Then they hire the New York law firm, and the case settles on much better terms. That was the case with Alcatel-Lucent, another French company, which wasn't cooperating for about 2 years. And there's this fascinating agreement, where the agreement basically describes they were non-cooperative. We knew they had done it because their competitors turned them in. But we give them credit for the remarkable cooperation they have shown just in the last year when they hired the New York law firm, basically. But it could be that U.S. prosecutors are trying to level the playing field in favor of U.S. companies, and that they're targeting foreign companies in a way that they wouldn't. It could be that U.S. companies have more negotiating power. They know to hire the law firms with the former federal prosecutors that can talk to their old friends at the Department of Justice. And these firms absolutely do market their ability to get the company a meeting at the highest levels of the Department of Justice. It is routine for these cases to receive review, not just by the U.S. attorney, but by the deputy U.S. attorney and the U.S. attorney. Eric Holder will have personally discussed these particular, you know, the HSBC settlement, the big corporate settlements. They will reach the highest levels of the Department of Justice that regular cases don't. There's no rule about that. And, you know, plenty of U.S. attorneys say that, oh, if you ask me to review something one of my line prosecutors did, of course I would. Well, these cases go all the way up. And so, but it's very, very hard to know what the explanations are. This is just a pattern. The other feature of these cases that I wanted to note is that the fines, the actual criminal punishment piece of this is only a small part of it. Far more money is paid to victims or in forfeiture. Far more money is paid to regulators. And it's hard to know whether civil cases settle and what the amounts are. Civil settlements are often confidential in the U.S. because the corporate defendant normally doesn't want people to know what it's settling its cases for. But at least the observed civil settlements that accompany these deferred and non-prosecution agreements, at least, are larger than the fines, and there may be much more than that. I should note that these numbers that I'm giving, I should say something about where they came from. There was no place to look to find out information about corporate prosecutions in the U.S. exactly. The U.S. Sentencing Commission keeps data on people, individual people and corporate people, that are sentenced in a courtroom. The problem was that starting in the last decade or so, starting in 2003 really, the biggest and most important companies more often than not receive these out-of-court settlements, these deferred and non-prosecution agreements. The Sentencing Commission has no information on those cases. And there was no collection of them. There was no way to know what was happening in those cases. Early on, these settlements attracted my interest as a former civil rights lawyer, actually, because I was intrigued that prosecutors could get all sorts of institutional reforms that civil rights lawyers could never get if they were prosecuting as private attorneys general. A prison that was violating prisoners' rights or a school that was discriminating. Those cases would be before a judge, and judges strictly monitor the remedies. But when prosecutors are doing it, there are no rules. So I began to collect and archive these deferred and non-prosecution agreements early on. Over the years, we've also done things like use Freedom of Information requests to the General Accounting Office, although they mostly relied on my website to get information. But they uncovered, they did an inquiry in 2009 where they found a few more agreements. A First Amendment clinic that we have at the University of Virginia, and I'm not sure why freedom of information necessarily relates to the First Amendment or speech rights, but whatever, it was very useful to me. They took on as a project suing the Department of Justice to locate some agreements that had been kept sealed for reasons that are unclear. And we've now received most of those. We're still suing over a few more. And if they're obstructionists, we're going to ask for all kinds of fees, and we've embarrassed them, and it's kind of fun. So we've amassed this archive, which is available online, and there are links to it. We're redoing it over the next few weeks. Hopefully it'll finally be done, although I don't know. It was supposed to be done in the fall. You can search by company and by a few things, but it'll be updated hopefully soon so that you can look at just foreign bribery cases or the cases with the biggest fines or just the public companies, because I have all that information. It shouldn't be that hard, but it's taking time to create a website where you can look at all of that. Now, I also took on a much more complicated project of tracking down and creating a corporate crime register, really, of all of the companies that are convicted every year. Many more companies are convicted every year than enter these out-of-court deals. And so there's over 2,000 companies that have been convicted since 2001. But most of those are small mom-and-pop companies, not particularly interesting cases. The Sentencing Commission is not happy that I've done this because they keep anonymized data. I wanted to make sure that no individual people were named, but I have fewer qualms about a corporate offender registry than an individual offender registry. That said, I do feel a little uncomfortable with being the maintainer of a offender registry. But I do think that the public should know when a company commits crimes in a different way than if individuals do. What has been particularly interesting is that so many of these companies receiving the out-of-court deals, the deferred prosecution agreements, non-prosecution agreements are slightly different. They aren't even filed with the court. They're just, we agree not to do anything in your case, but you have to follow these terms, which is different than a declination, where there'd be no agreement. We're just not bringing a case against you because we think you did nothing wrong. A non-prosecution agreement is, we're not prosecuting you, but you did something wrong, and you've admitted you've done something wrong. You accept responsibility, but we're not prosecuting you. We will, though, if you don't fulfill these terms over the next 2 or 3 years. Now, many of these are Fortune 500, Global 500 firms. More than half were public companies. So these public companies are getting, again, the most lenient out-of-court deals, where you think that's not fair as between companies. That is, the smaller companies receive the harsher consequence, the conviction. But of course, the concern is that the public companies can say, we're public, we're big, we're important to the economy, we're reputation sensitive. It's particularly important for us to avoid the collateral consequences of a conviction. Now, you can see that, again, there are many more convictions each year than this little slice of deferred non-prosecution agreements. But the really interesting cases are concentrated among these out-of-court deals. the agreements with public companies, the agreements involving the biggest billion-dollar fines. Here's another way of showing it. Public companies now, for the most part, more often than not at least, receive these deferred and non-prosecution agreements in black. There are still some public companies every year that do get convicted, though. And they aren't destroyed. They plead guilty to crimes. And so it's not exactly the death knell to be convicted of a crime. I've argued that more companies should be convicted, just like any criminal offender is. Yeah.
And how much of this do you attribute to a revolving door between the prosecutors
right.
and the big law firms like Paul Weiss and Sutherland Cromwell, Davis Polk, who have these prosecutors then as senior partners, who clearly have an open door to the Department of Justice? Is there a direct correlation in your view with the kind of statistics you're describing?
I don't think there is. It's obviously an extremely... You have a very high-paid future if you have been, for example, in the fraud unit of the Southern District of New York, mm-hmm. or in the criminal fraud section doing foreign bribery cases at Maine Justice. In 5 or 6 years, you can be a partner making $2 million a year. And for that reason, though, those units attract incredibly aggressive and brilliant young prosecutors. And so they do get people who really want to be aggressive and show big victories. And so in some ways, they have all the incentives to bring bigger and bigger cases to show how good they are so that companies will hire them to avoid precisely the thing that happened to their competitor. And so it's hard to say. There are other reasons why it's just impossible for these small groups of prosecutors to bring cases this big. The prosecutors in the Eastern District of New York that prosecuted HSBC, that office would have been lucky if it had had two prosecutors assigned to the case, maybe two FBI agents. Maybe if they were lucky, two prosecutors and a supervisor spending a lot of time on it. HSBC was hiring entire law firms. It's routine for companies to spend hundreds of millions of dollars defending these cases. Debevoise and Plimpton billed, I think it was $800 million to Siemens when it was representing Siemens in a very successful resolution of the largest foreign bribery case of all time. And they paid hundreds of millions of dollars more to outside auditors and experts. Basically more than $1 billion was spent by Siemens in investigating itself and defending itself. So this is wonderful work for my students. There's all this interest in taking corporate crime-related classes at U.S. law schools because there's an enormous amount of work in these cases for huge groups of lawyers to read all the documents. Prosecutors, it's understandable that they would settle these cases in this way where they can't realistically look at the documents themselves. They're relying on the company to show them what happened and what was important and who did what. And they're relying on the company to monitor itself over the next 2 to 3 years and show that it's improved things. And therefore, the case can be dismissed. So they're miserably outgunned. And even the revolving door concern is sort of the least of it in terms of what prosecutors are up against. In some ways, that's what really attracted me to this subject. It was sort of a lovely change for me to see prosecutors as the little guy, as the David. I'm not used to seeing prosecutors really the most powerful type of enforcer in the U.S. And U.S. prosecutors have much more power than prosecutors in just about any other country in the world because of the sentencing guidelines and because of a tradition of prosecutorial discretion and lack of oversight. And here you feel bad for these guys. What changed that created this whole system of out-of-court deferred prosecution agreements with corporations? What changed in 2003, and it didn't change by accident. There had been some principles in place for what you do when your criminal defendant is a corporation, and they actually were drafted by Eric Holder when he was Deputy Attorney General under Clinton. And then Arthur Andersen happened. And I tell the story of the Arthur Andersen trial in the first chapter of my book, because it really announces a new era of corporate prosecutions. It was also an incredibly interesting trial. But Arthur Andersen is prosecuted for obstruction of justice. They shredded just enormous quantities of documents related to their work with Enron, because they knew they were in very big trouble. And they had dump trucks full of documents every day leaving their offices in Houston. The they pay a fine, but they are then debarred from doing work with public companies by the SEC, and this Big Five accounting firm goes under. There's all sorts of criticism. Prosecutors destroyed this accounting firm. Why did they do that? Prosecutors felt quite justified in what they did given the scope of the crimes committed by Arthur Andersen. But nevertheless, they announced these new principles, encouraging prosecutors basically to go easier on companies and to take into consideration things like the collateral consequences, say, on employees that didn't have anything to do with it. What if it's just a small group of rogue employees? Do you really want to punish the whole company? Could prosecuting those individuals alone be enough? You know, do they consider whether just to prosecute the head of compliance, his bosses? Could they have just prosecuted the people at HSBC who were doing this? Or was it so systemic? Maybe it was. Certainly that was Carl Levin's view. That really is appropriate to hold the company accountable too. Or could the regulators take care of this problem? You know, if we think that, you know, say like the Environmental Protection Agency, the nuclear regulators, here in the HSBC example that I've been focusing on, right, there was a perception that the regulators couldn't take care of anything, that we absolutely can't depend on them to solve this problem. So there are factors having to do with sort of who did what within the company. These factors are sort of more about corporate culpability. So was this a really serious offense? Was it pervasive within the company? Did the company have a record? HSBC had all those things, but very serious offenses, lots of them. Sounds like it was pervasive across operations across the world and had been going on for many, many years. And so these factors, by the way, don't reflect the law in any way. The law in the United States is unusual. There's no country that has a standard like this. Prosecutors in the U.S. have a quite powerful tool and a doctrine that dates back to a 1909 case, New York Central versus Hudson, a doctrine of a concept familiar from tort, respondeat superior, where if there's a single employee acting in the scope of employment that commits a federal crime, that the company is accountable. Now, Congress could change that by statute, but Congress has instead adopted the principle across a wide range of federal crimes that if a single employee does it, the company is on the hook. Now, what these factors suggest is that prosecutors don't prosecute every company where an employee commits a crime in the scope of their employment. Instead, they want to see a company where it wasn't just one employee, where there was something more pervasive, where there was, you know, pervasive wrongdoing, it was a serious offense. And, you know, there are thousands, 10,000 people prosecuted for fraud alone in the United States every year. A lot of business crime is prosecuted every year. In the vast bulk of those cases, no company was prosecuted. So maybe 10,000, 15,000, it's hard to count, white-collar crimes every year committed in a business setting. Less than 200 companies are prosecuted every year in the United States. Now, this middle set of factors has to do with the company's good conduct. Did the company come forward on its own? One aspect of corporate crime, which makes it different than a lot of types of crimes, is that, although fraud often has this character, if someone's defrauded, they were fooled, they were deceived. They may not have any idea that they were fooled or deceived. Corporate crime has a way of staying concealed within the corporation. And that, because of that, self-reporting is extremely important, and prosecutors place understandable weight on a company coming forward. Tell us something we didn't know about. Did the company have a good compliance program and something just sort of slipped through the cracks? And what have they done about compliance? What have they done to make right on this since it came to light that there were these corporate crimes that had been committed? And so prosecutors focus on that compliance aspect as well, at least in the terms of these agreements. But when you look beyond sort of, yes, you must improve compliance, hire a new compliance officer, I became increasingly concerned with the pattern across these agreements. Because one aspect of this memo is that it really reflects an idea that finding the company isn't enough. We have to think about what this corporate offender is like. We need to look at these companies not as individuals, but we need to look at how serious the sort of culture is of tolerating misconduct, and we need to try to fix something in the company. We need to do a structural reform here to prevent it from happening again at this company. Well, how seriously do prosecutors take that? They can impose a fine. They understand that the fine will be paid by customers, the cost will be passed on to shareholders. The right people may not actually feel the brunt of that fine. So how do you do something to the company so that the right people feel the impact of a criminal prosecution? That's really the question. And this memo doesn't explain that. They don't say what you do to the company to change it to prevent the crime from happening again. Now, when I looked at the terms of these agreements, and here's some coding of them, well, most of these cases impose some kind of compliance reforms, but there are a lot of cases that impose none, that said nothing about compliance. Now, why did you prosecute this company if there wasn't a compliance problem? Either you shouldn't have prosecuted them at all, or you prosecuted them and are just sort of not saying anything about how the company is supposed to change. What I was particularly disturbed at, though, is that it was a small minority of these cases that said anything about auditing the compliance to check whether it's working or not. So typically, there will just be some generic language, HSBC adopt effective anti-money laundering programs. Well, what is an effective anti-money laundering program? And in HSBC, there was a corporate monitor who was supposed to look at the effectiveness of these programs. Most of these cases have no monitor. Here are the ones that have a monitor. That leaves a lot of cases with no monitor overseeing the compliance process. There's no person there to do it, aside from the company saying, we're going to report to you every 6 months, every year. We'll tell you how it's going. Monitor in the HSBC case was an eminent person. These monitors also often get paid an enormous amount of money, in part because they have to hire large teams of high-paid lawyers and then other professionals. It's usually the monitor is the head of a large team. If you think of what it would take to watch over compliance at a company like HSBC with operations all around the world, it's a serious job, and it's a five-year job for Michael Cherkasky. A year into this agreement, HSBC recognizes, it's going to be a long journey. We know we have a lot to do. And the judge actually said something unusual in one of these cases. Most of these judges say, well, it's a deferred prosecution agreement. It's not really a case in front of them. The prosecutors are dismissing this case eventually, and there's no trial in this case. This case is frozen on my dockets. We are tolling the speedy trial clock. The idea is this case will be dismissed if the company shows good conduct. Well, Judge Gleason basically said, what am I, a pot of plant here? This is a case in my courthouse and on my docket in a way. I'm not just going to sit here and then be told in 5 years that everything is fine. I want you to report to me every few months, and I want to know what the monitor is doing, and I will make public at least some portions of what the monitor concludes, because this is a case of public importance. And if you're not going to bring this case to trial, then I want to know what's happening, and I think the public has a right to know too. So I was very happy about that. That was one of the things that I had argued would be important in my book, since so much of what happens in these cases is totally non-transparent. If a company pleads guilty, at least there's a plea hearing where they have to do things in public and explain what crimes they committed. And the implementation of these agreements, totally non-transparent. No one has ever read, except in maybe two cases, the reports of a corporate monitor doing oversight. Well, we know something about oversight in this case, because the judge ordered that the reports be provided. And all along, apparently, the monitor has been saying that things are still a shambles at HSBC. They lack integration, coordination, and standardization. I think that I love that they apparently have certificates, I am a changed bird, they've been giving to employees to thank them. I'm sure that's worked enormous cultural changes. Although in a we're here in El Sols, where a bird, the mallard, is very important. So maybe actually identification with a fowl is important for a certain esprit de corps in an organization. They've hired thousands of employees. They certainly on paper have done things that sound really significant. They've hired, I don't know who Lord Jonathan Evans is or Robert
Warner. Former Chief Stye.
Yeah, I got the sense that these were quite distinguished people and important people that were being hired. And so, what that sounds, those are the, that sounds significant. They made major hires. You know, does that mean that they've changed? They changed their leadership as well. Is it now a change to bank where this prosecution actually accomplished what prosecutors really want to do, not just get a big fine to be paid to the U.S. Treasury, but actually to prevent future crime, to actually change a crimogenic environment at a major corporation? Maybe this is a success story. There's one way where this clearly was not a success story. If there are any in this room that think that sometimes individual people should be prosecuted if a serious crime is committed, I don't know if there are any in this room that think that. No people were actually prosecuted at HSBC. And you think, well, that's interesting, because in a regular case, sometimes prosecutors can get a cooperator who has lots of information about a crime. But it's the rare individual case, unless someone is wearing a wire and is a really key person, where you have the kind of information that a corporate cooperator can provide. Because HSBC, and in that deferred prosecution agreement, they agreed to cooperate in every way, any document you want, any email, any internal communication. The prosecutors have everything. They can find out exactly who did what, and access to email at a major corporation like that. Remarkable access. They could figure out exactly who these employees were, and in fact, the statement of facts described things. They described, right, that compliance head who was complaining and got fired for bringing to light serious failures. There were amazing emails. We don't know who the authors were because it was blacked out of the public version, but the prosecutors know. They know about, who told, an employee was told to F off when she brought up that that Hamas was a terrorist organization, and so you probably shouldn't have money flowing to them. I mean, just unbelievable stuff in these emails. And yet HSBC is one of these cases where no individuals are prosecuted. And this is a follow-up to the book that I'm still working on. I wanted to see how often individuals were prosecuted accompanying these agreements. Only about a third of the time are individuals prosecuted. And I say that in the book, and I say that only about 24 of them were CEOs, another dozen were CFOs. Most of the people who are prosecuted are fairly low-level, up to mid-level employees. But I also wanted to find out, and that took more work, and this is an article I've been working on since the book came out. Well, those individuals who are prosecuted, how many of them get jail time? It turns out far fewer than is average in comparable fraud cases, money laundering cases, antitrust cases. Typically the result is no jail time, some kind of probation, some kind of a fine. There are a few cases here and there. Bernie Ebers, a CEO, got 25 years. There are a few high-profile cases where someone quite high up is prosecuted. There are very, very few of those. And in general, individuals are not prosecuted. When they are, they're not necessarily the people that you would like to see singled out, and they tend not to receive jail time. So there was a review, which I was very happy with, written about my book by Jed Rakoff, a federal judge, and he talked a lot about the Pfizer prosecution, the first billion-dollar prosecution in the United States. There were two individuals prosecuted in that case, but they went to the judge that sentenced them and said, we're sales managers. We do manage people who are illegally selling this drug off-label, but there are a lot of supervisors above us. I mean, sales manager is not a fancy title at a company like Pfizer. We were doing what we were told. We were telling our sales agents to do what we told them, but there were many, many levels up above us who were telling us to aggressively market this drug off-label. Why us? Why just us two? There are a lot of salesmen. There are thousands of sales managers and tens of thousands of sales employees. And the judges in both of their cases basically agreed and said, yeah, probation. Why you? And I can sympathize. Elizabeth Warren has been prominent in saying that in a case like HSBC, HSBC actually brought out the phrase too big to jail, which I think at the time I thought was creative, but lots of other people have used it totally independently before the book existed. Individual people go to jail for a long time for money laundering. At HSBC, not only does the bank settle out of court, but no individual people are prosecuted. The House subcommittee actually created this little monopoly card, which they gave as a present to the Obama administration. And I don't know whether that's fair use of the monopoly imagery, but and then what's remarkable is that, well, is HSBC a changed bird? Some of you may have seen the news this spring that there have been remarkable revelations. I'll get to that in a minute. The Monitor, as of this spring, has said that compliance is still seriously deficient at HSBC, despite their hire of the former head of MI5 or whatever, and hiring close to 10,000 new employees. But there are also these revelations, separate revelations, about Swiss banking, that apparently during the same time period, they were doing some of the same stuff that other Swiss banks were doing, aggressively marketing tax shelters. Apparently the biggest financial whistleblower of all time was in France. Released all these documents to a whole network of independent media organizations showing what was going on in each other. So a totally different crime happening during the same time. And meanwhile, there is this judge, Judge Gleason, who has said, I'm exercising supervisory power over this case. So I'll be very interested in whether Judge Gleeson asked the parties to brief is HSBC in breach of this agreement, because we now know it was committing other crimes during the same time period. Could HSBC be found in breach because it sounds like it's not complying that well, although it's spending a lot of money trying to revamp its operations? Or will the judge say, this is largely an out-of-court deal, my responsibility over this thing is quite limited. If prosecutors are happy with HSBC, then I'm happy with HSBC. And at the end of the 5 years, the agreement will be dismissed, and no one will hear about it again. Now, I should tell you that higher authorities than me insist that the too-big-to-jail concern is not one that should concern us. And this is my last video clip, and then I'll end in a minute. This message dates from last summer.
There is no such thing as too big to jail.
And so when he said that, I realized that I should try to put a stop to the book. And the publisher said that it was too far along at that point, and I had no particular choice over the matter. It was out of my hands. What was interesting is that what he then says is no financial institution is beyond prosecution. But of course, that doesn't answer the too big to jail concern. You know, HSBC, this isn't a case where they intended to create money laundering. Well, actually, that's not the standard. Recklessness would be perfectly, would be enough. Willful disregard. There's an ostrich instruction that famously addresses that problem in U.S. courts. But it's a separate question. Are the individual employees too big to jail? And how about the too big to jail related concern with not, is it above prosecution? HSBC was prosecuted. But does the entity actually get convicted? Does it have a criminal record? If HSBC gets prosecuted again for this stuff involving Swiss banking, it has no criminal record. It can say, we're not a recidivist company. Don't give us any enhanced, we're not in violation of any probation because we have no criminal record. Our last case was settled out of court. There's a separate too big to jail concern with the substance of the agreement, forgetting about form. If one doesn't care whether it's a conviction or a deferred prosecution agreement, the question is, what are the terms of this settlement? Well, were they paid a deterrent fine that's going to send a message that no one should ever do this again? They were paid a highly reduced fine. And how about the non-fine terms? Are those terms, those compliance terms, actually going to fix the company? It sounds like so far, not so good. The monitor is upset that they've made such halting progress. And so there's a whole family of these too-big-to-jail concerns. And one of my goals in the book is to, although I think it's a memorable phrase, and I'd like to try to complicate the phrase to argue that there are many, many difficulties in bringing corporate prosecutions. I sympathize with the quite talented prosecutors who are often bringing these cases. I'm not surprised at all that they feel the need to compromise in deep ways when they resolve these cases. But I certainly wouldn't want anyone to hear the message from the Department of Justice that we are bringing in billion-dollar fines that no one has ever seen before. We are triumphing over corporate crime. I think not so much. I do think that these cases, and you know, is HSBC a changed bird? I don't think so. I do think that these cases really raise the concern that we are uncovering perhaps more serious corporate crimes than ever before. But the cases are being settled in this novel out-of-court way that we've also never seen before. I'm not convinced at all that despite the real revolution in corporate prosecutions in the United States, that we've solved the very difficult problem of how to police corporate crime. I'm not sure it's a good thing that countries like the UK are imitating the US approach. It's sort of taken off in many other countries across the world. But I do think that this is a difficult problem for which there are not clear answers. And I end the book saying that corporate prosecutions are themselves too important to fail, that we really do need to pay attention to how these cases are brought and continue to put pressure on prosecutors in the US to explain what they are doing. If nothing else, just so that we know more about what their priorities are and to what degree companies are actually being held accountable on the ground. So I'll stop there, and I'd love to talk about this more broadly.
Brendan, that was fascinating, both the content, and I think that's probably the most sophisticated presentation that All Souls has ever seen. Maybe we'll ever see you again. We're not used to that in All Souls. So we have 25 minutes for questions, comments, and there are already some questions, so I can